Welcome back to Fire Interview, the Storyteller Podcast. I'm your host, Brendan Trainer. Today's guest is Wes Trainer. Wes is a retired battalion chief. He did 37 years with Phoenix Fire. He was a firefighter. He was a paramedic, a hazmat technician, a technical rescue technician. He was on FEMA, Arizona Task Force 1, USAR. He was an engineer, a captain, a battalion chief, and a division chief. He is the godfather of engineering. He's done everything from recruit firefighter testing, writing the test, promotional exams, interviews, tacticals, writtens for engineer, captain, chief, shift commander. He's done testing for over 30 different cities. We're going to get into all of that, as well as some major incidents he was on, like the Jason Schechter Lee incident, the Southwest supermarket fire where Brett Tarver called his mayday and lost his life. We're going to talk about the drag rescue device and the Tarver strap that are in your jackets now from that incident. He is a wealth of knowledge after 37 years with Phoenix Fire. He's got a lot of great lessons to pass down. We're very excited to have Chief Wes Trainer. As always, Fire Interview, the Storyteller Podcast, is brought to you by the book, Fire Interview, the Storyteller Method. This book is a book to help you score full points and stay on track during your fire department interview. You can get the book at fire-interview.com along with all of our podcast merch. You can also get the book on Amazon. We're also brought to you by publicsafetyanswers.com. Public Safety Answers provides all of your recruit testing needs for your department. They have behavioral and cognitive exams online. They also have one-way video interviews that they can provide to your department showing all the candidates. There's an unlimited number of applicants. It's a great program, so if you're interested in using that for your department, go to publicsafetyanswers.com for more information. Right now, applications are open for Payson Fire Department in Arizona. The applications close on September 12th. If you want to apply for Payson Fire, go to publicsafetyanswers.com/Payson Fire Department registration, or you can go click on the link in the bio on our Instagram at fire_interview. Chief, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me here.
Is it weird for you when I call you Chief or Wes?
Yeah, a little bit.
So for those of you that have not put it together yet, retired Chief Wes Trainer and I are related. Imagine that. He is my father. We're really excited to have him here today. And I always wonder that because we also, one of the companies that I'm an owner of, we're both owners of, and in business meetings and stuff, I always feel like I should just call you Wes. I feel like it's weird if we're giving a presentation to some big department or something and I go, hey, Dad, do you want to... I don't know. I just feel like it's more professional when I say Wes.
I think you're right.
But it's equally awkward for me.
But most of them have already figured it out, too. It's not that hard to put together. There's...
Yeah.
The last name is it's not Smith, you know?
Yeah. It's, well, just so you know, it's equally awkward for me to call you Wes, but I think it's also weird for me to call you Dad in certain settings. So,
yep.
So tell us about when you started with Phoenix Fire. It's 1979?
Yeah, 1979. I actually tested with, because at the time I wasn't sure, do I want to be a police officer? Do I want to be a firefighter? I got in the right line because at least it worked out that I made the right decision. It's not that I didn't know which one was higher than the other. And my backup plan was that I was all set. All I had to do was sign. I was going to go in the Air Force. So I took the test with Tempe Police, Tempe Fire, Phoenix Fire, and I hate to admit it, Rural Metro Fire. And so Tempe Police called me first, and we were probably a week from the academy, and then I get a phone call from Phoenix Fire saying, hey, you're hired and you're in this academy. And so I said, okay, I'll take that. And I called Tempe back, said, yeah, thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah.
And so I made the right choice instead of being a police officer.
And for the record, because I worked for Southwest Ambulance, which was owned by Rural Metro, my first job when I was 19 was on Southwest Ambulance. For those of you who are listening who are on Team Green, also known as Rural Metro or Southwest or now AMR, at least in our state, has made a big front.
When we joke around about being on rural metro or on private ambulance, it's not the staff that we're joking about, especially like on our Instagram and stuff. Every once in a while, somebody gets offended and they're in the comments all jacked up. Cause we did it. We were there, right? Whether you worked for rural metro or you worked on the ambulance or wherever you were at. And so just as a side note, when we joke about that stuff, we're mostly making fun of the company and what terrible conditions we were under. And we were talking to a chief in a presentation the other day, and he said the same thing. He said, it's not, the employees are doing the best they can with what they have. But like in rural metro, when you get a 2-man truck and your second due truck is 20 miles away at best, like those guys are doing an awesome job. But, when, just so you guys know, when he's joking about rural metro, it's, for those of you that work there, we know that you're doing a great job. He's talking about the equipment and the company does not have a great reputation.
Well, and that's exactly right. And there's a story that goes along with that. Back in, I think it was the early 90s, the town of Gilbert, where we lived, was rural metro, was the fire service for the town. And there was a group that was trying to get it changed to a municipal department, which obviously, since you work there now, we were successful with that. And the guy who was kind of in charge of it is actually a chief. He was a chief in Tempe. Now he's a fire chief in West Valley department. Came to me and he said, you know, you speak in front of classes and so forth all the time, so we would like you to be our spokesperson at the town council meeting. And I said, okay, that I would. And then they started to tell me what it was I was going to have to say. And part of it was basically bad-mouthing and bashing the firefighters who worked for Rural Metro, who worked in the town at that time. And I basically told them, no, I'm not going to badmouth any of the Rural Metro firefighters, but I'll be more than happy to talk about why the company is not good for the citizens of Gilbert. But, and so basically what ended up happening is that somebody else did that job and I kind of backed out of it.
Yeah. So it's 79, you end up getting picked up by Phoenix. What was your interview like in 1979?
Well, back then we only had one interview. There wasn't the two that we traditionally have, at least in the Western United States these days. And actually, one of your recent guests on this podcast, Dennis Compton, was the main person on my oral interview. And he's the only one who did any talking. He sat in the middle. He was the chief. The other two were captains. One of the captains just wrote notes and didn't say anything. And the other captain sat at the end of the table with his feet up on the table, and he had his mouth full of sunflower seeds, and he's just spitting sunflower seeds all over himself, the table, and the floor, and never said a word during the interview. So it's a little bit different, I think, than what we would have today. Certainly, I would hope.
You would hope so, right?
I would hope that no one would be doing that during an interview process. But, you know, it was 1979.
Do you remember what the questions were back then?
Well, I don't exactly remember, but more or less the two typical questions that are still around today. You know, why do you want to be a firefighter? And what have you done to prepare yourself to be a firefighter? And then I think the other one was a scenario type question, and it basically went like this: is that you're the senior firefighter on the crew, and your captain comes to you, and there's somebody there for maintenance, and they have to go up in the attic, and they want somebody to go up with them to help them, so the captain sends you up while the least senior firefighter doesn't have to go in the attic. And of course, you know, it's Phoenix, it's 100 and whatever, about 130 in the attic. And they say, well, how would you react to that? And so I basically told them, well, the captain is the boss, and the boss has the opportunity to ask you to do different jobs and do different things. and they know better. Maybe they have some reason that they want me to go up there versus the younger firefighter, and maybe they have some other job for the younger firefighter. I don't know, but it's not my role in this situation to question why it is I was chosen to go in the 130-degree attic and the other firefighter wasn't. And
yeah.
So it was fairly simple, pretty straightforward. But
yeah, so that's interesting. The questions haven't changed a whole lot since 1979 to 2021. Still kind of the same basic premise, right?
Kind of the same thing, although I think most departments have gone away from doing scenario-based questions.
Right.
It's more of a, you know, they might ask you, tell us what diversity means
right.
to you, tell us what teamwork means to you, those types of things.
The list of core concepts.
Yeah.
Those of you who are listening who've read the book Fire Interview, available at fire-interview.com.
All right.
So you finish your interview, you end up getting hired by Phoenix Fire, you're in the academy. Things are a little bit different back then. Did you have day boots? When did you end up finally getting bunker pants? You're still riding tailboard at this time,
yeah.
right?
So we had, in the academy, we were issued bunker pants, but mostly what bunker pants were a place for small animals to live in them on top of your locker or underneath your bed at the station. No one ever wore them, ever. Because, well, they're hot and kind of cumbersome, and we had day boots, and we were allowed to wear those. Of course, the interesting part was the pants that they had us buy were the Levi Nuvo jeans, which were, I think they were basically 100% polyester, so basically you're wearing shrink wrap just waiting to bend over for the heat. So that wasn't very good.
So tell us about your hood and why our family is not multimillionaires.
Well, our academy class was actually the first academy class to be issued hoods in the academy. And in fact, some of the folks that were out in the field weren't still wearing them. It was an optional piece of equipment at the time.
And for the non-firefighters, we're talking about the Nomex hoods that you see like race car drivers wear. Firefighters wear those too, and keeps you from getting your neck and your ears burnt.
Yeah. So the original ones that we had, the face piece, and it's just a big round oval. It's not the eye ones that you see the race car drivers. It's just a big round opening that your mask basically sticks through. And they had no elasticity to them. So what would happen with them, and what happened to me on one of my first fires, was that I got burned on the side of my face, both sides. And some people would say, well, you still have the scar, but, you know.
You just looked that way.
That's their opinion, yeah. So what I did was I took my hood and I took it to my mother-in-law and I said, can you sew elastic into this? And so she did, and then I wore it. And the next fire I went into, it was nice because the hood, the mask, and the mask were almost integrated. The hood pulled itself around the mask, kept that heat from getting in there and burning my face. So I showed it to a chief officer, and I have no idea to this day who it was.
Chief Nomex?
Chief Nomex. Apparently his family's doing well. And he confiscated it from me and said, you've altered a piece of safety equipment, and you can't have this. And he gave me another one that didn't have the elastic. And probably about 2 months later, everybody got new hoods, and they all had elastic in the face. So apparently he took my idea and probably got rich off of it. But
probably.
That's how it goes.
So what was your first fire like? Do you remember what engine you were on and what it was like pulling up?
Yeah, I was on engine 23. That was my first station, which is down in southeast Phoenix. It's a, we'll call it a very less affluent area of town. And so the first fire that we had was just a house fire, but it was kind of, we didn't even know the term then, but today we would call it a hoarder house. And so myself and Toad Westfall, Tom Westfall, was a senior firefighter, and we just crawled our way in there. It felt like we were in tunnels at times trying to make our way back in. But we put the fire out and everything was fine. The worst part of that fire was when I came back out and the engineer had moved the truck, and my brand new Wellington boots that I bought, one of them had fallen off and he ran it over with the front tire of the truck, and so I had to go buy new boots. That was the worst part of that day, but I was still pretty jazzed about having a fire.
Yeah, I remember my first fire where we were the first in truck on a legitimate working house fire. It was December, and there's so much that's different from the academy. It's hard sometimes to get realistic training, even though we have great burn props and great instructors. Like, one thing is, this is going to sound really dumb, but I get off the truck and I'm not sure where the house fire is, because the house that was on fire was on the other side of the truck. So I get off, I'm all excited, I'm not listening to the on-scene report, you know, I'm just ready to pull hose and go. I know it's a working fire from the column on the way there, but I get off the truck and none of the houses I'm looking at are on fire. I don't know where to go, so I just start running around the truck, and my senior firefighter, Jack Glover, he's got the hose bundle halfway pulled off the truck, and he's calling me over. Hey, come here, little buddy. And he points over to the house that's this one right here, little buddy. And he puts the hose pack on my shoulder, and I run up and drop the hose pack, and I'm masking up. And at this time, we didn't do door control or anything. We didn't know any of that kind of stuff. So the door's open. There's black smoke just pumping out. You can hear the fire roaring. I'm on my knees masking up. It's like the movies. And there's this motion sensored Santa out front, and as I sit down, it sets off the motion, and it's singing Jingle Bells, Jingle Bell, Jingle, as the smoke's pouring over me. It's like something out of the movies. And then we go in, and you know, this high heat, zero visibility. And I remember thinking, in the academy, when they used to black us out, put our hoods on backwards, and they're trying to stress you out, and they're yelling at you, and you can't communicate, and it's no visibility, I'm thinking, these recruit training officers are exaggerating. You know, they're messing with us.
Oh, they're not, definitely not exaggerating.
They're not. Yeah. And you don't realize until you go into, I had one of my firefighters, he had his first house fire a couple months ago. And same thing. He was surprised to see that you can't really communicate. You're screaming at each other. I don't know what in the fire is making so much noise, but something in a house fire is making an unreasonable amount of noise.
I believe it's a fire consuming the building.
And it's true. You have zero visibility. You have high heat. You have very poor communication. And so I always think about that from my the academy days. You get off and you know exactly what building's on fire. It's the tower that's designed to be on fire, and
yeah,
you know,
it's the
layout.
The only building they set on fire.
Yeah,
today.
It's like so. Cheating. And then when you get to real life, it's so much different that, you know, I get off the truck, I'm not even sure which house it is. My senior firefighter's going to call me over.
Well, then the other thing in the academy is you always pull the hose line, and you would pull the line out until it was straight. You just keep running.
Yeah.
Because there was plenty of real estate. And you'd run until it was fully laid out, and then you would mask up and open the nozzle as part of that whole drill. And then in the real world, you pull it off in about 15, 20, 30 feet, you got nowhere to go.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of differences from training to the real world. So you're a firefighter, you work your way up, you go to medic school right before you become an engineer.
So I went to medic school in 1981.
And medics was just kind of a new thing at that time.
It was, they were new in like 75, kind of a result. And those of you that are medics out there and doing that kind of work can actually thank Johnny and Roy.
Yeah.
Johnny Gage and Roy DeSoto from Emergency, because there were literally people on the city council who watched that show in the evening and thought, why don't we have that?
Yeah, Chief Compton talked about that a little bit.
And so, yeah, and so that's exactly where it came from. And so we opted to get into EMS. I think 75, 76 was the first group of medics. So, I tell people in Arizona, and those of you that are not in Arizona won't recognize this, but my original medic number was 406.
Yeah, which is low.
And, of course, today it's all five-digit numbers.
Yeah, I think mine's 75213 or something like that.
Yeah, so I had a been around a little while as far as a medic, and we did the same thing that if you watch the old episodes of Emergency, where you get a code and the first thing you do is flip the caps on the amp of bicarb, and you give them 2 amps of bicarb,
yep.
And then you give them some epi, and then you go, well, what else we got?
Yeah. The drug box has changed a little bit over time.
Yeah, you guys now have a lot more choices than we had back then.
So was the Jason Schechterly incident? Were you a firefighter paramedic?
Or no, I was a captain.
You were captain when that came along. So
that was in 2001.
Okay. So before we get to that story, you end up promoting to engineer. You're an engineer for how long?
I was an engineer for 11 years. I really enjoyed that job. It was great. I was a medic engineer, so I still did all the medic stuff, but drove the truck, yeah. and pumped the truck. And
you never were going to be a captain, huh?
Well, you know, that happens in people's careers, you know. I know some people say, oh, yeah, I don't ever want to be an engineer or a captain. I just want to be a firefighter. And one of two things happens. Either they get their wish and they get to be a firefighter, and I knew a few. There was a guy in my academy class, Steve Ohab, who retired after about 34 years as a firefighter still. And he just, that's what he enjoyed, that's what he liked doing. And fortunately for him, his body held up.
Yeah.
The second thing that happens is, as your body starts to wear out, because it takes a toll on you, then pretty soon you're going, yeah, maybe I should promote so that I don't have to work quite as hard.
Yeah.
And if you want to extend your career, sometimes you have to promote so that you can take advantage of some of the opportunities that would come your way if you were a captain versus still being a firefighter or even being an engineer.
Yeah, and I've told people this. There's nothing wrong with being a seasoned senior firefighter. I think sometimes there's almost a lack of seasoned senior firefighters. But at the same time, as your career goes on, another way to look at it, instead of saying, well, you know, I'm not as physically capable as I once was, so I have to promote, is that at some point they start paying you for your mind and not your body.
But well, it's a good thing, because I'd have been broke.
Yeah. Because when you're brand new, they're paying you for your body. Nobody expects you to make any decisions or take command of anything. They expect you to
be paid to kick the door down.
Yeah, you're a workhorse. And then at some point, you transition into being like, okay, maybe you're not the workhorse that you were when you were 19, but now we're going to start paying you for your mind. We're going to start paying you to make good decisions and take care of these young door kickers. So you transition a little bit. So you decide that you're going to become a captain. And then I know you would never test for chief, right? You would never be a chief.
Well, no, that was about the same. Yeah, I said kind of the same thing when I made engineer as I did when I made captain. I'm not going to go to the next level. I'm good here.
Yeah.
But,
you'd never be a 40-hour admin chief, right?
Well, see, that's the thing in Phoenix is you don't have a choice.
Yeah, you just get told you're the training chief now.
The chief tells you where it is you're going to work if you're a chief officer in Phoenix. So, but yeah, I when I was an engineer, I also went through hazmat class, and then later as a captain, I went through TRT class as well.
So you're a paramedic, you're hazmat, you're TRT, you're firefighter, engineer, and then captain.
Yeah.
Any certifications you're missing?
Well, I worked at the airport, but never got the ARF certification, and I was also never an arson investigator. And I think those are the only two I missed in my career.
So let's talk about, we were talking about medic school a little bit. Let's talk about the Jason Schechterly incident. For those of you who don't know, Jason Schechterly got burned really bad. He has the Jason Schechterly Ball now in Phoenix, runs a great charity, puts people through college, people's kids through college, does a lot of great things. And you were the first paramedic on scene. Is that correct?
Yeah, so back then, Engine 5 was actually the first one on the scene, and it was kind of an interesting thing because Jason and Engine 5 were actually going to the same call. And I think it was just like a check welfare type thing. And Engine 5 had one of their firefighters overslept the call, And so they had to wait, go back and wake him up, get him on the truck. They went. And so, and that actually ended up being fortuitous because Jason was stopped at a red light and got rear-ended by a taxi cab going approximately 100 miles an hour. And basically all Engine 5 saw in front of them, because they were at the same light, was this ball of fire sliding across the intersection in front of them. And of course they could tell it was a police car, so they got out and started trying to control the fire and get him removed from the car. And at the same time, I was the captain on Engine 4, at the same time we were coming back from a gas leak call, kind of the bane of the hazmat world existence. And I could hear the captain on Engine 5 yelling on the tactical channel that they needed help and where they were. And we were only about 12 blocks away, so we just made a left and hightailed it down there. The cab driver, actually I think it was the cab driver's fare, so he had somebody in the car when he's doing 100 in the middle of the night, was laying underneath the bridge on the underpass. And so I dropped off my medic and one of my other firefighter with that person, and we drove on up. So we helped Engine 5 get Jason out of the car. He was burned so badly. I mean, Rescue 11 showed up. We threw him in the back of Rescue 11, and I took him to the hospital. And he was burned so badly that if you'd asked me, I would have said, yeah, he's about an 80-year-old black man. Just terrible burns. Got him intubated, got him to the hospital.
And for the record, he's not an 80-year-old black man.
No, he's like a 26-year-old white guy. So
yeah, but he's burned so bad.
He's burned so badly, that's what he looks like.
So you get him intubated, you're in the back of the rescue.
And we get him over to the county burn unit, and so I'm doing my paperwork. And if you'd have come to me and asked me what I thought about his chances of survival, I would have bet my entire next paycheck that he would not live past the morning. And this is like 1-2 o'clock in the morning already. But he did. He survived. An outstanding guy, and still alive today, some 20 years later, a little over 20 years now. He and his wife had a couple of kids, and I think he's in Texas right now because his kid's playing ball. So he's down there with his kid playing. I say kid, he's probably 18, 19 years old now.
What's it like on an incident? You know, I know when, it's going to sound a little bit harsh, but when we go on calls for people who are critically injured, we compartmentalize it pretty well when it's somebody that we don't know, that's not a firefighter or a police officer. You know, and it doesn't necessarily make it easier, but we kind of compartmentalize it. We take care of them. We move on with our day. Was there anything different knowing that he's a police officer, like an extra level of stress for you, for your crew, for the hospital?
Well, I think anytime you have a patient that you know or that you're somehow connected with, and in this case, I didn't know Jason, never met him before that I'm aware of. And but he's another public safety person who worked for the same city, so there's a connection there. And yeah, it's difficult. I think that when you're doing the work, when you're actually dealing with, in this case, Jason, and getting him out of the car and getting him intubated and getting him to the hospital and all of that sort of stuff, that I think you still have to compartmentalize there, because if you don't, then you risk losing control of what you're doing and not thinking about what you're doing and becoming too emotional about it. And there's time for the emotion later. And actually, the department, the two departments, police and fire. When he was able to, several months later, they had Jason and his wife come to fire admin, and we all sat in a big conference room, everybody from Engine 4 and Engine 5 and Rescue 11, so that he could not just meet us and say, hey, thanks, that kind of thing, but he couldn't remember anything that happened, so he wanted to get the firsthand story of what we saw, what we did, what happened, what was going on. So that helped quite a bit. And then there were some other get-togethers that happened. We went to a Diamondbacks game, and we were in one of the suites, you know, with Jason. And so that was a lot of fun, a little lighter.
Yeah.
So
another thing that you're known for is basically being the godfather of engineering, we'll call it. So tell us about why, when I say that, tell us about the West Trainer method, your formula, how that came to be.
Back in 1988, and I remember that because that's when they first announced the Cardinals were coming from St. Louis to Phoenix. I was teaching EMT at Mesa Community College, and the coordinator called me one day and he goes, hey, you're an engineer, right? I said, yeah. And he goes, think you can teach hydraulics? I said, sure. Okay, the hydraulics class is yours because the other guy just quit. And so I thought, well, I'll just go in and I'll teach it the same way that I learned it back in 1980. And so that's the way the semester started, and that's the way it went until about three quarters of the way through. I'm sitting there going, well, what am I going to tell these, how can I make this better for the students than what I had in 1980, where at the end somebody actually asked the instructor, so how do we use this on the fire ground? Because none of us are the Rain Man, right? We can't do the math, a lot of those math problems you can't do in your head.
Yeah.
And so basically he said, here's a chart, memorize this chart.
Right.
When I took my engineer's test, I had to memorize a chart for it. So what I ended up coming up with was a fire ground method to for the hardest part, which is the friction loss and figuring out friction loss. And I came up with, there's actually two formulas. One is for all of the 2.5-inch and smaller hand lines. The other is for 3-inch and larger hand lines. But they're formulas that you can, once you learn the formula, you should be able to do it in your head. It doesn't require a calculator or pencil and paper. And so I came up with those basically out of the desire to have my students have some sort of advantage when they got done, in some way to say, here's what you can do on the fire ground. It's not exact, but it's very close, and right, it will work for you.
So for people who are non-firefighters, turning on a fire hose to the correct pressure is a little bit more complicated than turning on your garden hose outside your house. If you give them too much pressure, you can lift the firefighter right up off the ground with the hose. And if you give them not enough pressure, then it kinks and they can't put the fire out. So there's all these things that come into play. The size of the hose, how much water you're getting from the hydrant, are they elevated, how long is the hose coming off the truck, all these things that you have to factor in, appliance values and all this other stuff. So it was this big, long, complicated formula that you couldn't do in your head. And basically you wrote down on a napkin a formula that you could do in your head that also, by the way, worked for multiple cities. Because if you worked in one city, you had a 5-inch supply line. Another city had 4-inch supply line. And one city has 1¾-inch hose. Another has 2-inch. Another has 3-inch. So you basically, at lunchtime, if I remember correctly, wrote down a formula on a napkin that pretty much worked for everybody.
Yeah, I got the hand line one just in a matter of about an hour, and then and it was a little bit of trial and error, but came up with it. And then I think a couple of days later, I sat down, okay, what do I do with the bigger hose?
Yeah.
And the bigger hose one was, turned out to actually have been easier to put together. You know, it's the good part about it is that if you're on a department and you only have inch and three quarter, 2.5, and 4 inch, let's say, then you can disregard the hose size factors mm-hmm. for everything you don't have, and makes it even easier for you, and it still works.
So that's the other thing. We have the Nomex hood, and then you coming up with the Fireground formulas. The two reasons that I should be driving a Ferrari, but I'm not.
You've had a couple of Cobras. You're driving a Tesla. I don't know what to tell you. I'm driving an F-250.
So that's really what started your reputation as the guy, the engineer guy. And then at some point, you start to transition into not only teaching engineer classes and writing promotional process for those, but also doing recruit firefighter promotions test, captain's test, shift commander, battalion chief for pretty much all of Arizona and a couple of other states. But you became the promotional guy.
Yeah. So, again, I mean, it's a typical deal. It's a little bit like the phone call I got, hey, can you teach hydraulics? I got a phone call from Van Summers, who was, I think he was the division chief over the training academy. And I was the driver training officer. And he said, hey, you write your tests for the, you know, college classes and stuff. I said, yeah. He goes, you think you could write a promotional exam for us for engineer? And I was still an engineer at the time, even though I was working out of class as a captain and as a driver training officer. And so I said yes, and I did it. And as it turned out, probably by accident, is the format, the way that I went about putting the test together, the Phoenix Human Resources or Personnel Department, you know, they look at all the statistics afterwards on the test, and they said it was actually one of the best promotional exams they ever had, police, fire, everybody. And so then I was the one to write all the engineers' tests from that point forward. And then we had a chief who shall remain nameless, who was tasked with writing the captain's test one year. And he's a little bit different guy. And his tact was that he would read the material and then he would make up in his own words what the questions were. Whereas when I do it, if you put the right answer in the blank, in the item, you can go back and read it word for word or the bibliography. So it's not my interpretation of the material. And so they gave the test, and in Phoenix, the people who take the test are able to go in and review the materials and review the answer key and appeal any questions that they want to appeal. And of course, they have to have supportive material from the bibliography that supports their appeal, why they chose the answer they chose. And then those are all reviewed, and decisions are made as to whether or not the appeal is upheld, or, you know, it's double keyed or thrown out or whatever happens to be. And of the 100 questions, 79 of them got appealed.
Which is not good.
It's not good. So they had me, I did the next one. 2 years later, I did the next one, and we had 4 questions appealed. And none of them upheld. So then I became the captain's test writer, too.
So do you have any advice that you would give to somebody who's getting ready to take a promotional exam, engineer, lieutenant, captain, for their exam, their interview, their tactics? What's the quick version of, I come to you, hey, chief, I'm looking to test. Where should I start? What should I do? I've got all the minimum qualifications done. How do I stand out in this process?
So I've actually done a lot of that over my career. I did a bunch of it at Station 4 with my crew and the ladders crew that were wanting to take the captain's test. And most notably, I suppose, was my last 3 months on the department before I retired. I actually spent every weekday morning that we got off and invited anyone who wanted to come, and I did classes on exactly the question you're asking. And just as a result thing, of the 15 people who came to that class consistently throughout those 3 months, 14 got promoted on that next test, and the other one came out number 5 on the next test after that. And as far as my crew goes, they all got promoted except 2. So maybe it's just they're smarter than I am, so they figure it out in spite of me. But basically what I do is I tell people, first thing you have to look at is usually the written exam, and you have a bibliography that goes with that. And you need to look at what are the major pieces of the bibliography. You need to divide your bibliography into 2 tiers. So tier 1, for example, for Phoenix test, volume 2 and IFST company officer would be the 2 big pieces. In other words, they make up about 50 to 55% of the test. And so what I tell them is get those and start studying those first and work your way through those. And I tell people, if you're going through volume 2, for example, which is our standard operating guidelines, read the material, then go back and read it again and highlight, but only highlight the things you don't know. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you go through a page in that and there's nothing new to you, you knew everything on the page, tear the page out, throw it away. Because you're looking at a couple thousand pages of material to begin with.
Yep.
So get through your tier 1 stuff, and some people make flashcards. I say, you know, take and read those highlights onto audio. Shows my age, but audio tape, whatever mm-hmm. they call it now. And that way you can listen to that and therefore study, even when you're doing other things like driving or working out or mowing the lawn, whatever it is, you can still listen to it. Whereas mm-hmm. if you have flashcards, you actually have to sit down and do that. You can't be doing other things. Then you go through all of the tier 1 stuff. And what I tell them with the tier 1 stuff is pretty simple. Look at the rest of them and go, what do I know the least about? Okay, if you're not a hazmat person and there's hazmat on that tier 1 stuff, maybe that's your next thing.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the volume 1, the policies group. And then obviously the other 2 big pieces are typically going to be the tactical and the interview. And with respect to the tactical, I know a lot of people don't like the term template, and maybe I should call it something different. But I have what I gave them, and what we went through was called a captain's tactical template. And of course, when you practice tacticals, a lot of people will begin with, okay, there's the building that's on fire, and you start with your on-scene report. If you look at my captain's tactical template, and it's not a way to have to, you know, it's not the assignments that you need to make, it's the thought process that you need to go through to make the right assignments. And it's not until the middle of page 2 that we talk about doing an on-scene report.
Right.
Because there's so many other things prior to that that you need to look at. And it even starts with at the very beginning of the shift, and who's your crew, who are the other crews around you, who are the captains that are going to be responding with you, what kind of time on the job and experience do your crew members have? Do you have is it your regular crew? Has everybody checked out their equipment? Do they have all their personal stuff? Have they checked out their bottles? Do you have your accountability in place? All of those little, and a lot of them are just little things that we just do every day. But being aware as a company officer that all those things got done can help you to be a little more reassured. And then you get the dispatch, and now you're listening to the radio. You're looking at, if you're lucky enough to have computer systems, and especially if you have mapping systems that allow you to go to actual satellite aerial views mm-hmm. and zoom in, is you can learn a lot about where you're going by taking a look at the satellite views of it on the way. and of course listening and looking and all of those things. So it's a little ways into it before you're actually ready to do your on-scene report.
Yeah, so you really need to define what your strategic decision-making process is, as opposed to memorizing what your tactical benchmarks are and how to get to them. And for those of the people that are not firefighters that are a little bit lost about what we're talking right now, when we talk about a tactical, we're talking about major incidents like a house fire, commercial building, major car accidents that have multiple trucks, hazmat incidents, technical rescue incidents. Those are what we call tacticals. So part of the test is they test you and they show you videos or pictures of a building on fire, let's say, as one of the tacticals, and you run it as command for X amount of time. And then when we talk about tactical benchmarks, those are things that need to get accomplished, like a primary all clear, meaning have you searched the building, and fire control, have you put the fire out, lost stop, are you done tearing up the building, what we call personal accountability report, or a PAR, are you accountable for all the members that are on scene? So when you kind of relate that to like a... For the people listening who are in the private sector, or maybe you're not a firefighter, before you get into a project and just say, here's the goals and here's how we're going to accomplish them, how did you get there? Right? Like, just like you're saying, what is the makeup of my team? What is their experience level? What's the goal of this? And one of my favorite quotes that you told me when I was getting ready to test was, there's this big debate in Arizona over whether you should have something called rescue sector or on deck. And to explain what those are is, rescue sector is a dedicated team that for the whole duration of the incident, they sit outside and they're prepared to rescue downed firefighters, basically. And they have some other tasks, but for the most part, they get stuck sitting in the front yard, and rarely do they get put into action as rescue sector.
And they're not usually happy about it.
And they're not usually happy to get rescue sector. The other option is that you can be on deck with rescue responsibilities. Same thing. It's a team of people sitting in the front yard with the exact same responsibilities, but they get to go in next and someone else becomes on deck. Just like in baseball, you're next up with the responsibilities of a rescue team until you get called up. And we'll get into the Tarver incident that you were on and the difference between why rescue is not real effective as its own sector. But the quote that you told me is, basically, don't be a slave to your tactical worksheet, right? And drive your assignments of your sectors, or for people who are not firefighters, drive your assignments of your personal company or whatever personal project you're working on. Drive your assignments to meet whatever your objectives are at that time. So if, you know, like Eddie said on our first podcast, you know, if you put the fire out, a lot of these other problems will go away.
Absolutely.
And so you have these newer captains or people who have this thought process, well, I got to set up rescue sector. Even though you have no control over the fire, you have tons of spaces that haven't been searched, but because they're the third engine in, they want to automatically make them rescue. But there's all these tactical benchmarks, all these things that have not occurred yet that you haven't taken care of because you're being a slave to your tactical worksheet and going, well, the third engine has to be rescue. And like Eddie said, and like I know you say, Eddie's from FDNY, for those of you who didn't listen to episode one, and whether you work for FDNY or Phoenix, if you put the fire out, all these problems will go away.
that's exactly right. And you know, they came out with this saying, well, the third engine company to arrive is automatically rescue. And I thought, this is just ridiculous, because if you're the incident commander, as long as you have tactical needs, in other words, you need something addressed, whether it's a search, putting water on the fire, ventilating the roof, forcing entry, whatever it is you still have that you need to get done to meet the objectives that you outlined a little bit earlier, is that you need to make those assignments to make that thing, those things happen. And it becomes a bit of a luxury then, or if you use on deck, it would be a luxury if you could just always take and put somebody as rescue. But if you put someone on deck, then you can use them to meet whatever tactical objectives you haven't accomplished yet, or something new comes up. Because basically, if you're on deck, you function as rescue. You do all the things that the rescue sector used to do. But you can also, and the most common thing is you would be relieving the crews that are operating on the interior that were there prior to you getting there. Or you could be relocated to somewhere else if something else happened and they need a company to move and cover another area of the structure. Or you could just be put in behind the people that were in there ahead of you just to reinforce them. So rescue, relocate, relieve, or reinforce, basically the four R's. And it's functionally, it's much better because you still have people who are, because you'll replace them. And so you still have people who are concentrating or thinking about and prepared for rescue, but you're still meeting your tactical objectives and your tactical goals by taking care of those problems. And like you said, you put the fire out, a lot of those problems go away.
Yeah, it's like the hazmat saying, after enough time, the incident will resolve itself one way or the other.
Yeah, most hazmat incidents, if you wait long enough, they will go away on their own.
So what's your, I already know the answer to this, but what's your pet peeve? The fire's over, everybody's over in rehab. What's your pet peeve after the fire?
So I think the main thing is, and you'll see this, and it's usually younger firefighters, but not always, but you'll see, and especially if a department doesn't get a lot of fires, is they'll come out, they fought the fire, they did a good job, they put it out, and come out, and they're high-fiving, they're having a good time. It's like they just won, you know, a World Series game or something. And and if you think about it, though, that who's watching that? Well, the people who own the house or the building, they're watching that. The neighbors are watching that. The voters, the citizens who pay your salary and vote for whether or not you get that next bond election to get more equipment or stations, they're seeing that, and it doesn't match with their feelings about what just happened to their house and their belongings. And so, if you want to high five back at the station when there's nobody around, knock yourself out. You can do your end zone dance for all I care. But let's not do it in the front yard. Let's not show that side of things. And the other thing, too, is I worked much of my career in South and Central Phoenix, less affluent areas. And I always thought we should work a lot harder doing salvage, pulling stuff out, moving things out into the front yard so they didn't get damaged further for those people versus the people in more affluent areas. And the reason is those people probably don't have insurance, and therefore everything that just got destroyed, that's everything they own.
Yeah.
And there's no, the State Farm agent isn't going to show up with what's his name from the Packers and say, here, let me write you a check.
Aaron Rodgers.
They're just not going to show up for that because they don't have insurance. Whereas the people in the more affluent areas, yeah, it's sad, it's bad, it's not good for them, but at least they have a backup where the insurance company, Aaron Rodgers, is going to come out and say, let me write you a check.
So ultimately it comes down to customer service, right? And I make this joke all the time when I'm preparing people for firefighter interviews, when I talk about the importance of customer service. And I tell them, I say, you know what people do, let's say there's a fire and we burn their house to the ground, whether we made all the right decisions or we made all the wrong decisions, their house burns to the ground, you know what they do? They bring us cookies.
Yeah, they thank us.
And I tell him, you know, why do you think that is? Because if I invited a plumber to my house and he flooded my house, I wouldn't bring him cookies.
And that is true.
It's that customer service aspect. And that's what the reputation, the 200 years of fire service reputation, it's not built off of risking our lives. It's not built off fighting fires. It's not off of being a master of your craft. Those are all great things. But the reputation that the fire service has is built off customer service. And that excellence in customer service is what gives us the trust in the community. And that's exactly what you're talking about with not high-fiving in the front yard.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a combination of good customer service and professionalism. And I think that, you know, years ago, I mean, when I first got hired, we never talked about the customer or customer service. That was something that in his book, actually, Alan Brunicini brought to the forefront, is that we should treat every person we encounter as a customer. And if you think about that, it's an easy way for the firefighters to learn and understand what that means. Because when you go to a store, or you go to buy a new car, or you go to a restaurant, you expect good customer service. Mm-hmm. Especially the more you're paying for it, the better the customer service should be. So it's an easy way, I think, for firefighters and people joining the fire service to kind of get a good picture of, okay, we need to provide customer service like we're a waiter in a 5-star restaurant.
Right? Yeah.
And versus saying, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that, this is why we do this, this is why we do that. Hey, look at the person and they're your customer. And how do you treat your customer if you want your customers to like you?
Yeah.
And, you know, not that we want them to come back. Obviously, we don't. But the reality is they turn what they see in the day-to-day things that we do for them as far as customer service, whether it's an EMS or it's a lift assist or it's a structure fire, they see those things that registers with them that it's good customer service. And they're doing everything they can, and there's the little piece about the risk in their lives if it's a fire, but mm-hmm. we're typically not risking our lives when we go in a medical call.
Right.
But we can still practice good customer service, and where that translates to, it's kind of like the waiter, right? If you provide really good customer service and the food's good, you're going to get a big tip. Well, our big tip is that these customers, when it's time for them to vote for us to get more money for stations and equipment, whatever, they're a lot more willing to do that, and they're a lot more willing to tell the city government that, hey, we think the firefighters should make more money.
Yeah,
we think they should have more stations, more personnel.
I remember learning my first lesson about the importance of customer service in the fire department. I don't remember what truck we were on at the time. I was doing a ride along with you. I was probably like 12 years old, which now you have to be 18 to ride along. And you probably had to be 18 then too, but the rules have kind of changed a little bit.
Well, they were a little more flexible then.
So I was a little kid. I mean, I don't know, 12, 13 years old, and I would do 24-hour ride alongs with my dad. And I had a little fake Phoenix Fire uniform and everything. And I did a ride-along with you, and we went on a call. I don't know if you'll remember this call, but it was assist bird from tree. This is what the dispatcher says. This is a service call, assist bird from tree. And we get there, and this lady's like an expensive parakeet or something got out of its cage and flew up into a tree in her yard, and she wanted the fire department to get it down. So they throw a ladder, and then it flies to a rooftop, and they throw a ladder to the roof, and it flies to another roof, and they throw a ladder to that roof. And I honestly can't remember if you guys got the bird or not.
I don't remember either, actually, but something in my mind says the bird finally flew to her or something.
Yeah. And I remember getting back in the truck and saying something to you like, well, Dad, that sure was a waste of time, right? Or that's not what the fire department's for. And you, like, not in a mean way, but in just a fatherly lesson way, said, that's exactly what the fire department's for. And I'm thinking, well, nothing was on fire and nobody was hurt. Surely he's confused, you know.
That could be, especially today.
And then you explaining to me, like, hey, we're not firefighters in a fire truck, right? We're problem solvers in the toolbox. And this person called with a problem, and our job is to solve that problem. And that's why we have the reputation we have, and that's why we have the trust to where a brand new mother will hand over her baby to a firefighter paramedic and have no questions about the medications that you're going to inject in them or whatever you're going to do to them. And there's almost no profession in the world that has this level of trust, right? We don't trust.
You don't even trust your doctor.
You don't even trust your doctor, lawyer, politician for sure, even police officers.
Nobody trusts politicians, yeah. But that's a different subject.
In the current climate, there's not very many professions you can think of where in my whole career, I've never had a parent stop me and say, I'd like to get a second opinion before you give my baby that medication. It just doesn't really, I'm sure it's happened, but it surely hasn't happened to me.
It never happened to me, and I think you're right. I think that's where you build that trust by displaying that you're trustworthy and displaying good customer service and being there for them and little things. I remember on your second podcast, Gina was talking about, that she was so thankful for the firefighters that she didn't want to call them, but she had to call them at times to come and get her back into her chair or into bed or wherever she needed to be moved to. And she didn't want to, but the thing that really hit home with me when she finished that story was that if it weren't for them, I'd have to live in a nursing home.
Right.
And from the time I was 18, I'd have to live in a nursing home.
For those of you who haven't listened to episode 2, Gina is a quadriplegic since she was 18. And part of the reason she lives independently is because occasionally the firefighters are able to come and help her out. So, the level of customer service and the trust, I know we've beat that to death, but that really is the core of what makes the fire department special, and doing the right thing, and whether it's a house fire or whatever, and sometimes the right thing's hard to do. I did another ride along with you. I had to be maybe 14 on this ride along. I was a little bit older, but I still wasn't driving, so maybe 14-ish. And I had broken my arm roller skating, and I had one of those casts on that goes up past your elbow and looks like I'm asking a question all the time. And I did a ride along. I think we were at station 18, if I remember correctly, because it had poles, had a second floor, 18. Had poles. And I was doing a 24-hour ride along. Again, this is all probably totally not kosher right now with
this didn't really happen if you're listening.
To have little kids, 12-year-olds, doing 24-hour ride alongs in Maryvale and Phoenix. But anyways, I may have been doing a 24-hour ride along. And we get kicked out in a house fire. And station 18 had, I think you had engine 18, engine 918. And
it was 718 at the time, but it's now an N-18.
Yeah, so there's a couple engines there. Well, when you get kicked out on a house fire, the whole goal is to be first to the house fire. So when you're at a station that has multiple engine companies, it's a big deal who gets out the doors first and who is trailing.
It is.
And it's the middle of the night. We get kicked out, and I run out to the pole to slide down the pole on this ride-along, but one of my arms is in this cast that runs past my elbow. And these poles, it's a big hole in the floor, right? It's going to fit big firefighters through this hole in the floor. And me, at my age, I was going to need to jump to the pole. I couldn't reach out, and at least in my memory, I couldn't reach out and put an arm and a leg around the pole and slide down. I was going to need to make the leap, right, with one arm. So I chicken out, I run downstairs, I'm in my socks, I run down the stairs and make the corner. There's a bunch of cops in the middle of the night at the kitchen table, and I slip in my socks and face plant onto the floor, and then I get up and do a Wile E. Coyote, and I'm trying to run with my socks on, and I'm not going anywhere. I hit the bay doors, make it out into the bay, and I see the backs of all the trucks leaving the bay. And I remember thinking, I can't believe my dad just left me. He just left me at the fire station. All the trucks are leaving.
The police were there. You're okay.
Yeah. And he gets back. It ended up not being a house fire. They get back in 5 minutes. Everybody gets canceled. And I remember you just telling me, well, if you're non-essential personnel and you're not on the truck when it's time to go, you don't go.
Well, we've left essential personnel sometimes too.
Yeah.
At that same station, we had one guy who, he liked to be kind of a joker. And so he thought that one evening he would go up and get into inside of a locker and another firefighter's little cubicle area there up there where he was getting ready to go to bed. And somebody saw him do it and told the firefighter whose locker and bed it was, hey, so-and-so's in your hiding in your locker. He's going to wait till you turn off the lights and lay down and jump out, try to scare you. And so the firefighter goes, okay, thanks. And he walks up, and the first thing he does, he walks into his cubicle, and without even looking, he just reaches over and slams the locker shut. And there's barely room for the guy inside the locker with it partially open, much less closed. There's no way to open it from the inside. And as fate would have it, about 3 seconds later, we get a first alarm structure fire toned out, and everybody takes off. And well, except for the one guy who was trying to pull the prank, he's still stuck in the locker. And we go, and it was a working fire, and we were gone for quite a while. And apparently, the way the story goes is that the crisis response van people showed back up and went upstairs and heard somebody banging on the locker and saying, "Let me out." And went over and unlatched the locker, and out he fell. And so he missed. He had a fun time trying to do the practical joke until he wasn't having fun, and then he missed a fire. So sometimes essential pieces of people get beaten too.
Whether you're a 14-year-old with a broken arm or you're playing a prank, you may get left.
It's possible.
So earlier we were talking about the difference between rescue and on deck, and I know Phoenix Fire did a big Mayday study, and I want to kind of back up before that happened and talk a little bit about the Southwest Supermarket fire. Can you tell us about that call? What truck were you on and responding, and just take us all the way through that call and what happened?
Well, I was on engine 4 that day, and we had actually got dispatched to a natural gas leak, again, the bane of hazmat's existence. And we were on the I-10 and about 27th Avenue and I-10, we got canceled. Well, the next exit is 35th Avenue and I-10, which is less than a half a mile from the Southwest Supermarket fire, and we heard that go out. And so we added on to it and staged. The incident commander had us pump engine 3's line, and then the other three of us on the crew were to go to the, we pumped the line on the northeast corner of the building or the parking lot, and then we were assigned to go take another line off of engine 24, which was actually on the southwest corner of the building. So we had to go pretty much halfway around the building to pull our line. As we're going around, I could see some pretty ugly smoke coming from the eaves, the bird block basically. And I told my guys as we got closer to engine 24 to pull our line, I said, hey, listen, stay together. We'll go in, we'll do what we need to do, but I think this is gonna go defensive really shortly.
And this is a supermarket that's stocked full of groceries. There's employees, right? Just to paint a little better picture, it's an open supermarket.
Open operating supermarket.
And when you say go defensive, for those of you who are not firefighters, what he means is that it looks like they're going to pull all the firefighters out and just spray water from the outside and basically write the building off as a loss. That's what going defensive means.
Correct. So... So having this in my mind, we pulled our line off of engine 24. We advanced into the, on the south side of the building, began fighting fire. And sure enough, probably within about 2 or 3 minutes of us being in there, command called for the fire to go defensive. And for basically means everybody get out. So I gathered my crew, we advanced our line back out, we got out, we thought, okay, everybody's getting out, we're gonna get a new assignment to go do something, put a master streams on the building. And about the time that we got out was when the Maydays began, and I think there were 12 or 14 Maydays altogether from firefighters who had become either lost and or out of air. And so a couple of the guys on my crew that had already changed out their bottles or in the process of changing out their bottles. Went in with another captain and one of his crew members. They were able to bring John Thomason out, and then another crew brought Heltzel out. Both of them were basically in respiratory arrest or near respiratory arrest. The medics that were on the scene started working on them. We got them ambulances, got them on their way, and then there was a report that the one missing firefighter, the first one to call the Mayday, that they had him and he was going out on the east side. And so at that point, I thought, well, good, everybody's out.
And just to fill a couple quick gaps, a Mayday means that a firefighter is lost or trapped or needs assistance or is running out of air. The definition is basically a problem that can't be solved within 30 seconds. So calling a Mayday, you say Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. And that is saying not that you found a victim. It's saying I or a member of my crew is in immediate grave danger. Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. It happens very rarely to have a Mayday on a fire ground. It's a firefighter saying, I need you to come rescue me. And then when you talk about the guys coming out in respiratory arrest means that you're not breathing.
Yeah, these guys have run out of air. Fortunately, the crews found them in time, and they both survived. And then, like I said, we were kind of standing there, and my engineer had come around and brought myself and one of the firefighters new bottles. And so we just changed our bottles out. We're thinking, okay, well, what is it that we're going to be doing from this point on? Are we going back to our truck, or what? Those decisions hadn't been made yet. We're making sure everybody got out. And so about that time, I hear on the radio, Mayday, 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 it's Engine 6. We have a downed firefighter. We're in the southwest portion of the building, which is basically where we were standing, or just outside of that. So I grabbed my crew member that just got a new bottle, and then there was two more guys from Ladder 1, and I said, you guys got full air bottles? And they said, yes. So let's go. So we go in. I'm getting on the radio because no one answered Engine 6's Mayday, so I called a Mayday for them and said we were going in. We got in there and we found Engine 6, and they actually had the downed firefighter that was with them. They were trying to drag out was the first firefighter to call the Mayday, Brett Tarver from Engine 14, a guy that we thought had been taken out earlier. And Engine 6 was out of air, or just about out of air, so we got Engine 6 out, and then we tried to continue to move Brett towards the exit. And at that time, there was a lot of smoke, fire above us, pieces of the roof structure that are on fire falling on us. It was a pretty frightening situation. And the worst part was that we didn't have anything with us to help move it. We didn't have a backboard. We didn't have a skeds board. We didn't even have, you know, small ropes and things that we could tie and pull in with. Those were all things that came along later as a result of this incident. And and a lot of training as a result too. And so I made the decision that, you know, we're running low on air now. Fire stuff's falling on top of us. We've gained about 2 feet in 15 minutes. And so I made the decision to take my guys out, because it was bad enough that the chief was going to have to go to Brett's home and tell his wife and kids and that Brett died, because it had been probably 45 minutes from the last time I heard him on the radio. And I was one of his recruit training captains, too. But so I said, come on, let's, we got to get out. So we started out and I got on the radio, called Cabantum. I needed a fresh company with full air with a backboard to the roll up doors at the southwest corner. And then, and we got there and it was ladder 20. When we came out, I told ladder 20, just follow this in right through here and you'll run right into him. And they were able to go in, put him on a backboard, bring him out, and we put him in an ambulance and worked him and took him to the hospital where, unfortunately, he was pronounced. But that just made... So 2001 was a really bad year for me because we talked about the Jason Schechterly incident earlier. The Jason Schechterly incident, if I remember right, happened about 6 days after the Southwest Supermarket, this incident. And then, of course, 9/11, 2001, which mostly what that did for you was ruin your 15th birthday, but...
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, my birthday is also September 11th. So when you're a captain and you're in this position, you've got a downed firefighter, I feel like this is one of those scenarios where the tabletop answer is so easy, right? To say, well... I would never leave a guy behind. I would get him out, right? I would muscle it up and I would throw him over my shoulder and we'd get out of there. And it's so easy when you're sitting around having coffee at the table. And the reality of it is you weren't making a lot of headway. There's a bunch of cans and groceries and stuff on the ground. It took you 15 minutes to go 2 feet.
This is actually, it was in the storage area. So there was pallets of stuff that had fallen and pallets themselves. Plus the material that was falling from the roof structure, you know, 2x4 purlins and chunks of plywood and all kinds of stuff. And so really difficult to move someone, even if they're a normal-sized person. To make it worse, Brett was probably 6'3", maybe 280. He's a big man. Mm-hmm. And so very difficult. Is not the type of person you're going to pick up, throw over your shoulder.
Right.
It doesn't matter how much adrenaline or Superman strength you manage to come up with. It's just not going to happen. Yeah. I mean, my firefighter, Maury, he's probably about the same size. Also another very big man. And there's just no way. The guys from Ladder 1, one guy's a pretty young guy and good condition, and the other guy's an engineer and he's a pretty big guy. I mean, we're all pretty good sized guys and we couldn't move him.
Yeah.
And by this time he didn't have his air pack on anymore. He didn't have his coat on anymore. So he's basically in a t-shirt and bunker pants. And so there's not even really much of anything to grab onto at that point to get any kind of leverage to pull him up. And the debris is probably of a good foot deep.
And you took your gloves off, right?
I took my gloves off to try to get a better grip, and I tried to grab down and get a hold of the belt area. And so I had one guy in the arms and the head, and two of us on the belt, and one at the feet. And we probably got, like I say, 10, 15 minutes, we probably moved him 2 feet. And that 2 feet was probably done in the first 30 seconds. It was not without having some extra training, which we eventually did as a result of this fire and the recovery from this fire, and you know the pull straps that you have in the back of your jacket now, those are direct result of this fire.
Yeah, what's now called a drag rescue device, but it's also known as a tarver strap. Mm-hmm. Is the other name for it. And it came from this incident. And I think that's one of the, you know, hardest decisions you can make as a company officer is trying to decide, like you said, how many doors do I want this chief to have to go knock on?
Well, and that's exactly it. And like I said, it's already bad enough. He's going to have to go knock on one. And I'm looking around going, do I really want him to have to go knock on four more?
Right.
And so it was just a matter of, I had to make the decision. Do we do we stay and not make any progress and run the risk of being in the same situation, or do we leave and get somebody with more equipment to get the job done? And once they were able to get a backboard under him and get him up on the backboard, the four of them were able to carry him
the rest of the way.
The rest of the way out. There's just no way to do it without a backboard or a skeds board or something along those lines.
And at one point, a chief actually had to block the door. Is that right? Because talk about what freelancing is and why it wasn't helping this. As you said, there was somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 or 14 maydays that happened after Brett's. So it's really rare to have a mayday on a fire department call. Yeah. And to have 12 or 14 is...
And they were all in the span of probably 3 minutes. And yeah, Ron Dykes, who was the chief, he was assigned as safety initially, and then he was assigned as rescue sector. And basically he was at the door that we had gone in and out of. And basically he's trying by himself to keep people from who are going, no, we're going in, we're going to go find these guys. And so it did get chaotic, and again we didn't really have a process in place for that at the time. So a lot of this mayday stuff, the tools, the techniques, all of the things that go along with rescuing a downed firefighter came from this incident, because prior to that, almost all of the firefighter deaths we had weren't involved this way. They didn't happen this way, where you had to drag somebody through a building. We had a guy that was outside and a wall fell on him. We had a guy who fell through a roof and into an attic space. So this was kind of the first time where we had a situation where you have to actually drag someone. And it's not like dragging them through a house.
Right.
Because there's tons of debris in there. It's in the storage area. Lots of canned goods and you name it that got knocked off the pallets. Some of the pallets themselves and so forth. And it's just, the whole thing's a mess. It's about a foot deep and...
Goes back to what we talked about earlier with the zero visibility and your hood on backwards is thinking these recruit training officers are messing with me. It's never going to be this hard. And, you know, we have what's called the confined space course or the confidence course now at the academy, which is where we make people crawl through this. It's basically a McDonald's play place from hell. And yeah, we tie them off in there, and we make them drag a downed firefighter through it, and we're playing heavy metal music, and it's zero visibility. And I know that they're thinking, like, that this is never going to happen. There's no way. And then you hear these stories from these senior guys like you that are like, well, no, it is going to happen. And here's some tools that might make you a little bit more successful. So,
well, and hopefully it never happens again, but you know, I'm realistic and I know that it will somewhere, mm-hmm. maybe not in Phoenix, maybe not in Gilbert, but somewhere it's going to happen. And so you really have to. The unfortunate thing in the fire service over the many years now is a lot of times it's a little bit like the government, to tell you the truth, is that sometimes the government will react to something that happened and make a new law or make a set of new laws because of something that happened that no one necessarily foresaw or took the time to foresee. And so in the fire service, it happens that way, unfortunately, is nobody kind of foresaw it, nobody looked at it, nobody said, well, what if this happens or what if that happens? It happened, we lost a firefighter, how do we recover from it? In fact, I was just talking on the phone today with Todd Harms, who's the chief of SAC Metro. He was one of our captains at the time, and he actually was assigned to run that entire recovery process, which elevated him eventually to assistant fire chief in Phoenix because he did a great job with it. Just talking to him today, as a matter of fact.
What was it like? Another thing that's changed a lot, we know we talked about how rescuing's changed. The equipment we have, the training we have, we're much better now at rescuing down firefighters, and we all have webbing and things and techniques to do that. Another thing that's changed a lot recently is mental health. You know, up until like 2 years ago, we didn't even have a mental health division on my department. There was no one assigned to handle that. Now we have a whole division of people assigned just to take care of our mental health. What's it like in the fire truck on the way back from that incident and at the station? You know, like we talked earlier about, obviously you're not high-fiving in the front yard. As the captain, did you say anything to your crew? Did you guys go out of service? Did you go home? What's the aftermath look like when this thing's over?
Well, you know, you're talking about a people that are, it makes up a third alarm fire. So for everyone to go home, which I suppose if everyone said they wanted to go home, they could have figured out some way to do that, but it,
not some, realistic.
At some point, it's not very realistic. That's a couple hundred people to try and replace in the middle of the night, which is going to be difficult. We went back to the station, and we talked. Our ladder truck, ladder four, they staged, but I don't think they didn't ever do anything. All they did was stage. So we talked to them about it. We talked, you know, to their crew about what we'd seen, what we'd done, the choices that we made, and all of those things, because they were kind of staged about a quarter mile down the road, so all they could do is listen to the radio. And I think that everybody in my crew, we all stayed the rest of the shift. And I think that sometimes that's just up to the individual. I mean, you'll hear some chiefs who will say, no, everybody needs to go home after something like this. And certainly their prerogative to say that, but I don't know that it's the right thing for everyone who was there to go home. For some people, staying at the station, being with and able to talk to the people that were there with you, that can make a big difference for people, versus trying to go home and now you're trying to explain it to your spouse or friends or family or whatever, and you're trying to explain things and they don't quite understand because they weren't there.
Right.
And so I think for me that was helpful, to stay at the station. And in fact, I think they called me to work overtime the next day at Engine 11, and I took it. And I took it with the idea that I want, you know, the same reason. I can talk to these guys, and I can, we can talk about what was done, what wasn't done, what I could have done different, suggestions anybody might have. And so I think that was helpful for me. Not saying it's helpful for everybody, but it was for me. But then, you know, after that, then I did go home, and I'd already talked to my wife, your mom, about it on the phone and so forth, and so she knew all about it, and so we talked some more. But having somebody to talk to is important. Who you choose that to be depends on the person. Is it the people that were there with you that actually experienced it? That may be the people you want to talk to about it. If it's somebody else who wasn't there, maybe that works for them.
Yeah, and I think there's a time and a place for everybody, right? Like, same thing with my wife. Well, I talk to her about something bad that happened. But not always first. And I don't think that's right or wrong. You know, I have a great support system. I know you have a great support system. But like, you know, our last guest, Nate Hahn, who was a Marine Scout sniper, he's talking about explaining things to his wife, and not telling necessarily all of the details of the story, one for her protection. And I know your wife is always like, yeah, you tell me anything, you know, and I want to know. And one, I feel like sometimes we're trying to protect them from like, hey, I saw something like really bad tonight and I just don't think you need to hear about it. Yeah. And then the other part is like he said to his wife when she watched that movie about D-Day, I'm forgetting the title of it now.
Saving Private Ryan.
And her grandfather was there on D-Day, and she could, and they're watching the opening scene, and she's just saying, you know, can you imagine him trying to explain this to you and to actually do it justice, you know, if you weren't there? And I think that's what he's talking about with, it's hard for him to tell these stories, and I'm always thankful for people like him and Eddie and you that are willing to come on this podcast and tell your story, because us young guys have so much to learn from it. But it's really hard. One, I mean, it's just a hard story to tell in general for you. I think that's the third time I've heard it in the last 20 years, and I'm your son. And the, you know, not only is it hard to tell, but it's hard to do it justice for the people that weren't there. And so for the spouses listening, wives or husbands, you know, just remember that if he or she wants to stay at the station and talk with their buddies about it and decompress a little bit and then talk to you about it later, it's not an insult. It's just there's a path, right, that you have to take of grieving that kind of incident, whether it's a drowning or a firefighter that you lost or whatever rough call it was. Some of it, I think, like I said, is that protection. Like, you know, I just don't think you need to hear this kind of story. I've been on a child abuse call that I didn't really tell my wife a lot of details about because, you know, it's good for me to decompress, but does she need to hear this? And then the other part is, It's hard to get someone to truly understand that wasn't there. And that's where I think, like you said, I think should guys and gals have the option to go home? Yeah, I think so. I think if somebody really needs to go home, they tell their captain and their captain arranges that. Should they have the option to stay? I think that can be healthy too.
You know? Absolutely. I think it was good for me to stay. And then, you know, when I was ready, then, and they didn't have any more overtime for me, so they sent me home anyway. So I got to go home and talk to my wife about it, and she was very supportive, and we kind of moved through that and the funeral and all of those things.
Yeah, those are tough situations, but like I said, you know, I know everybody listening really appreciates that you're telling that story. And like I said, I know it's not an easy story for you to tell because I think I've heard it in its entirety maybe twice in my whole life. So I know it's not easy for you, but I know that there's a lot for people to learn about that story. And I'll be sure to get to any of the questions that you guys have for Chief Trainer on Instagram and follow up if you have some more stories about his decision-making process before the incident, during, after, so that everybody can learn as much as they can. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. I know that we didn't even scratch the surface of all the things you've been involved in with being on Arizona Task Force 1 and USAR, and you were at Hurricane Rita, and you know, you've been involved in so many major incidents. You did 37 years with Phoenix Fire. You've been on just about every team known to man. You've been every rank, you know, so I'm sure that we'll have you back on, but I really appreciate you coming out, and thank you.
Well, thanks for having me, son.
Yeah, that's, well, we got to decide on the next podcast. Should I call you Wes, Dad, Chief? I rotate through
all
the things.
Well, you did all of the above on this one, so let's not break tradition.
All right, thanks for listening.